If we are to find a new house, let it suit us just as we are. You are a most sensible woman. And what a pleasant surprise to him is their harmony, the texture of those early days with Mary, which he did not know he had forgot, comes rushing back to him of late. It is the sensation, most of all, of not being habitually alone. The absent-minded reaching of her hand to his, the quiet clearing of her throat heard from another room, the half-surfacing from sleep when she rises to piss in the night, and having a listener to hear a joke or trouble over a problem, and always take his part. Angelica is not Mary, nothing like, but the many acts of being a husband to this second wife remember the first to him, and make her vivid in his mind again. There is a tap on the door, and Bridget puts her head round it.
"A letter here for you, missus," she says.
"For me? Not for Mr. Hancock?"
"For you."
Bridget brings it to her.
"There's a boy outside. Awaits your reply."
The paper is heavy and stiff, impossible to stuff into a pocket and forget about. Angelica brings it up to her face to better inspect it.
"I do not recognize the seal."
She slides her thumb under it.
"This is unusual. Who is writing to me?"
Her heart makes a little squeeze. What if it is somebody from her past, a man? What if it is her George? Her George. Her George. What can he want with her? Oh, what does he say? Bridget is hovering with idle interest. Mr. Hancock is staring out of the window and tapping his teeth, but surely he must see any moment.
"My dear girl."
But the writing is not his. It is rapid and neat and free of error. The creamy paper shows neither blotch nor smear. This is not young George Rockingham's work.
"Forgive me, my long silence. I think of you often and fondly, and now find myself at leisure to visit you. If it be agreeable to you, I shall arrive at 4 o'clock today for tea. Your old friend, Eliza Frost."
"Mrs. Frost."
The words tip out of Angelica on a great exhale.
"Mrs. Frost has written to me."
"Is that so?" says Mr. Hancock.
"She puts her address as St. James's, look. I think she will have very easily got herself a good position. What would you wager? That she's a housekeeper now? That is a job to suit her. I wonder if her employers know she's using their boy for her own errands."
Angelica, now being a wife, with all the necessary equipage, she keeps a silver pencil chained to her waist. Licking the nib, she hesitates.
"What shall I say?"
"Beg pardon?"
"She wants to visit me this afternoon. What shall I tell her?"
"Well, tell her yes."
"She never wrote to me before."
"Perhaps she was not at liberty to do so."
Mr. Hancock is not paying much attention. Angelica swallows to shift the bitter taste in the back of her throat.
"Why now?"
She puts her pencil down. She has a half-feeling, a bad feeling. If she were able to pin this feeling down and regard it properly, she might see that the thought of seeing Mrs. Frost makes her nervous. But Angelica's head is full of many feelings that she is unable to inspect. She picks up her pencil again. Aloud, she says,
"I would like to see Mrs. Frost again. She was my dear companion. She understood my hair."
Chapter 3. Mr. Hancock meets with Mrs. Brierly's agent on the edge of Blackheath, a wind-churned yellow plateau that drops away into the trees towards Greenwich.
"Fashionable," remarks the agent, who has heard of Mr. Hancock
and believes he has identified him as a man out of his depth.
"Very fashionable," Mr. Hancock agrees, "which will please my wife. She likes to be in society."
"I dare say," murmurs the agent, adding with absolute courtesy, "the barracks are only across the heath." Does Mr. Hancock hesitate? Perhaps his attention is only plucked away by the flight of a jay from one tree to another. For a moment his eyes track it, and then his big red face crinkles with pleasure.
"Such unspoilt countryside," he remarks. "Very pleasant. Very fine."
He stands for some moments looking about himself, with his fists wedged in his pockets, the wind whipping at his old stuff jacket. Then he turns his eyes mildly back to the agent.
"Let us see if this house is fit for Mrs. Hancock. Lead the way, sir."
They go through the gate and up the drive. The house Mr. Hancock will buy is white and square, with five bays most regularly spaced. The agent means to open the front door with a flourish, but the lock is stiff and the hinges in want of oil, and after a struggle he manages it with more of a clatter and a heave. He ushers Mr. Hancock into a large atrium with a checkerboard floor and dove grey panelling. If he had hoped to dazzle this drab, paunchy man, he must be disappointed, for Mr. Hancock goes undazzled. He follows his guide through high-ceilinged rooms, their steps loud amongst the dust sheets, and is inscrutable.
"Elegant proportions,"
the agent prompts him from time to time, or
"no expense spared, à la mode, à la mode."
But Mr. Hancock knows this already, and at any rate is not very interested. He remembers Angelica's instruction.
"Just as we are,"
blotting the butter from her wrist. But he cannot help but inspect the house as he would some consignment of Macau porcelain, not as a consumer, but as a gatekeeper. In such a situation, Mr. Hancock's first thought is never, "Do I like it?" but only, "Is it correct?" And since he sees that it is indeed correct, that this house, with its library, its stables, its six fine bedrooms, not to mention the fleshy ladies painted on the music room ceiling, is exactly the sort of house Angelica Hancock, the wife of a rich gentleman merchant, might be expected to own. This leads him to his next question. Is it quality? He taps away at the skirting boards and gets down on his hams to inspect the parquet. And he asks tiresome questions that the agent cannot answer.
"The marble, it's Italian? What workshop made the bedroom set? Will these stains come out?" "We might offer you a good price for Mr. Brawley's horses and Phaeton," says the agent recklessly.
But Mr. Hancock grunts,
"Yes, yes, we shall need those,"
and goes back to checking the French windows for draughts.
"I hope the kitchen is well appointed. An unhappy cook is a bad cook."
This pearl of wisdom is one of Hester's. Finally, they process through the garden room doors to the steps at the back of the house. It is a cool, bright day, but the marble has taken the sun so that a warm haze wavers around Mr. Hancock's stockings and brings out the sweat in the crooks of his knees. The lawn slopes steeply away from the house until it is swallowed up by trees, and the view towards Greenwich of treetops and fields is hazy and blue-tinged. On the horizon the Thames glitters, white sails puffing across its surface, as vague as angels.
"Well," says the agent, "it all seems in order. I might direct your attention to the folly,"
says the agent, pointing to a tiny Palladian temple that crouches half-concealed by the underbrush.
"Not just any folly," he continues, "for once inside. No, I shall show you. Come."
The grass is soft and dense under Mr. Hancock's boots. "It is the correct type of grass," he observes, "not prickly and faded, such as animals are grazed upon, but lush as new-dyed wool." For a moment he sees it lapping a child's bare feet.
"What grass is this?"
he asks.
"Where can the seeds be got?"
"Why,
only grass," says the agent in surprise. He must not know the other sort. For him, all grass is for lounging on. Nobody has tended to it for some time, and as the lawn inclines towards the folly's shaded corner, the grass grows longer, closing with a velvety swish around the men's ankles, still earth cold at its roots, so Mr. Hancock's shoes come up stained with dew and mud. What he sees in his mind's eye is a child's feet, running feet, running under the hem of a white nightgown, running alongside him through the hissing grass. He hears a little gust of excited breath, and catches the flash of rosy toes, and thinks, although it has never occurred to him before, "This is the life I might have given my Henry." In the other version of his life, in a garden like this one, a child is hurtling down the hill and into his arms. He feels its meagre weight thud into his chest, its hot cheeks against his face, its delicate ribs and pounding heart against his palms. And then he realizes, it is not too late. This ghost of a moment is not one that is lost, but one waiting to happen. He has a wife, does he not? He has a fortune, and soon he will have a fine house. Why, then, is the possibility of a child truly so unreachable? It is all before me. It has been waiting for me here all this time. This is what Mr. Hancock is thinking as the agent leads him between slender Doric pillars and across the threshold of the folly. It is musty inside, with the dense, damp cold of a place that rarely sees sunshine. The crumbs of last year's dead leaves are accumulated in the corners and against the legs of a large stone bench. The floor tiles are cracked and dirty, and the seashell-shaped niches that line the walls are empty, save one, where a trapped gust of wind makes the bleached vertebrae of a pigeon chatter like teeth. "He wants a good scrub," said Mr. Hancock. "Is this what you brought me to see?"
"Certainly not, sir. There's more." And indeed there is, for behind the bench is an alcove. And in the alcove, black with soot and gauzy with cobwebs, is the entrance to a tiny spiral staircase.
"Is it the coal hole?"
"No, no. This, sir, is the curiosity."
"Curiosity?"
"An oddity, merely. Something to see. Go on, sir." The stairs, vanishing into darkness, are narrow and uneven. There is a smell of wet stone.
"You want me to go down there?"
Mr. Hancock asks.
"You've looked over the rest of the place thoroughly enough," says the agent balefully. "I thought you would want to see it. It is the only irregularity in the whole property."
"Very well, very well."
The agent rummages through his pockets with little urgency before producing from one a tinderbox and from the other a stump of tallow candle. He hunches over this equipment and huffs, his hands cupped around it as if concealing a secret. Once he gets a light, he holds the candle up in his fingers, inspecting the flame.
"That will do," he says. "You'll not need it very long. Go down and take a look."
He puts the candle stub into Mr. Hancock's hand and propels him to the top step.
"Excuse me if I do not join you. It is not very clean."
The extra light does not reveal much. The stairs creep steeply out of sight between walls and ceiling daubed with rough plaster, which, as he descends the first few hesitant steps, gives way to what? Lumpy medallions, as if the wall were built from flint, or is it? No?
Yes? Seashells. Yes, seashells indeed, caked with dirt, and when he buffs a little away, he sees that they are not exotic specimens, not worth displaying, but mussel shells, cockle shells, oysters and winkles, the leavings from a thousand humble dinners. The next thing he observes is that these are not haphazardly jammed into the plaster, but carefully arranged, concentric circles of mussel and cockle and mussel again, chevrons and stripes and rosettes. The stairs are narrow and uneven, so he feels hobbled. He presses himself against the inside wall. Fingers spread helplessly as he lowers his feet out into the darkness, groping for the next step, if it exists, if he can trust it with his weight. Shale slithers under his feet. For a moment he loses his balance and tumbles, his heart leaping into his throat as he sees his own death rise up to meet him. He had not expected it to be so soon. He had not expected to come to it with such terror. But then he lands again, his backside coming down hard on the edge of a step in a burst of pain. He bounces off the wall and down the flight to land on a bare stone floor. The silence is extraordinary, as complete and as elemental as darkness, but he has seldom been more painfully certain of his own corporeality. After lying flat on his back for a few seconds at the foot of the staircase, he fumbles and staggers and creaks to his feet. Nothing broken, although he can feel the cloth of his breeches flapping around his right knee, and subterranean air cold on the raw skin beneath. His knuckles, too, are smarting, and when he brings them to his mouth, they are sticky and taste of iron. He has heard of the agonies of hell fire, but never an eternity of grazes. Purgatory would be the likeliest place for skinned knees, but he does not believe in purgatory. "If I were dead," he consoles himself, "I would be more certain of it." The candle is no longer in his hand, and yet, as he regains his bearings, he finds he is able to see a little. A greenish glow illuminates the brick floor, and the walls all encrusted with shells, arranged into the outlines of urns and lions, acanthus fronds and fish-tailed women. Such a peculiar light, though, like nothing he has ever seen. It emanates from somewhere to his left, maybe 30 feet away, and despite the pain sparking from his tailbone, he begins to move towards the archway from where it seems to him to leech out into the dark. He is at first afraid to leave the foot of the stairs, his route back to safety. But danger occurs when one walks into darkness, not away from it, and as he passes into the next chamber, he finds it identically adorned, but lit just a little brighter. Light spills from the next archway. And so he goes on. It is startlingly silent under the ground, the sound of his footsteps not quite his own. The air is thick and heavy, but stirred by little currents of cold air. And on he goes. There are 4 chambers in all, with vaulted ceilings encrusted with some queer, rugged rock and shell-encrusted walls, and each is a fraction brighter than the last. In the final chamber, he comes upon the source of the light. It flickers softly up the far wall, spreads and trembles across the floor. It expands across the darkness in little semicircular flutters, which grow out of one another, expand, and fade. What can it be? It is almost beneath his feet now. The air about it is particularly cold. "God's wounds," comes the voice of the agent, who has finally followed him down. "Do not fall in."
"Fall in?"
"Fall into the pool. Don't fall into the pool. Do you not see it?"
"Oh, of course I do. I do see the pool."
He perceives it clearly now, a black wedge of water dug into the black floor of the grotto, rippling with a very faint light all of its own, converging into stars that sway and shiver, and then disperse.
"What is this?"
demands Mr. Hancock.
"This is your folly," said the agent.
"I beg your pardon?"
The agent's expression is that of a conjurer whose favourite trick has fallen flat.
"Your grotto," he explains. "A shell grotto. It comes with the house."
"This?"
Mr. Hancock gestures to the pool, almost wordless in his confusion.
"How is this done?"
"I cannot say, sir. I'm not an engineer."
"But..."
His hand traces the weird flickering light up the wall. The agent shrugs.
"I do not know. It is ingenious."
"What is it all for?"
"It is not for anything."
"It has no function. There's no reason for it."
The agent sighs.
"Mr. Brierly was a person full of curiosity and addicted to amusement and novelty," he explains slowly.
Mr. Hancock's face is blank as a pudding. This ink-stained man, who demanded a yardstick so that he might measure the bedrooms, cannot perceive that sometimes a thing's beauty is in its very uselessness. He utterly lacks the genteel instinct to own something simply for the pleasure of calling himself its owner.
"Ask your wife, sir," says the agent. "Your wife will understand perfectly."
But Mr. Hancock himself understands. His wife? Yes, she is his.
The house, I will shortly be so. The child he dreamed of, indeed, may one day be flesh. But if this grotto is also to be his, he ought to take it as a very particular sign.
A slow and wondering smile crosses his face as he realizes that it has been vouchsafed for one reason and one reason alone. He is also due a mermaid.
Chapter 4.
Deptford, at the foot of the hill and on the edge of the water, is not fresh and wind-tossed, but chilly and damp. And in the Hancock house, the cold lingers in the corners, seeping through the floorboards and collecting in empty rooms the way cobwebs will. Mrs. Hancock has taken herself into the kitchen to keep warm, pulling a shawl around her shoulders and dragging her chair right up to the fire. She stretches her legs towards the warmth, so that her honest camlet skirt rucks up around her calves, and her stockings, clean enough and only slightly darned, twitch with the contented wiggling of her toes. She is knitting a little piece of lace, nodding over her work with her lips pursed, and as she tips her head forward, it might be observed that on the nape of her neck, between her plain lawn collar and her plain lawn cap, a few strands of golden hair drift in the updraft. Other than this, there is little to identify her as Dean Street's brightest diamond, except for the startlingly poor quality of her knitting. Now, as Angelica sits by the fire, she thinks, "Eliza will be pleased to see what I've made of myself." Sensible Mrs. Frost will approve of Angelica's modest clothes and quiet industry. "I am comfortable," she imagines telling her. "I feel very much myself." For although she is the least self-conscious she has ever been in her life, Angelica has a feeling that her errant trajectory has at last converged with its intended course. Anybody observing her at this moment would immediately apprehend that she was once a rector's daughter, or if not a rector's daughter, then the child of a gentleman farmer, or the better regarded of a flourishing town's two tailors, for while she is unwilling to cast her mind back to her origins, not one fibre of her body has forgotten them. She sits like the middling-class wife she was born to be, industrious even in repose, earnest and calm and scrubbed.
No need to change my dress,
she says aloud to the girls, absorbed in the industry of the kitchen.
No need to stand on ceremony.
She looks forward to leading Mrs. Frost around her house, kitchen and parlour, counting house and bedroom, over which she alone has oversight. How very neat it will all be. How Mrs. Frost's face will be wreathed in smiles.
I knew you would do well, my dove. I knew you would come right.
Are the stairs swept?
She asks Bridget.
Have you stoked up the fire in the parlour? I want it welcoming for our visitor. Go now. Go. And what am I to do?
Asks Suki crossly.
I'm a lady of this house, too. If you have a fine visitor for tea, I ought to be included in the party.
Angelica hesitates. She is uncertain what to expect of her meeting with Mrs. Frost. She does not want it overseen by Suki's bright eyes.
You will be bored. Pah! Pshaw! Bored? I know what you...
You know nothing. I'm an old lady now. I'm no longer interesting. You should have met me 5 years ago.
But what shall I write to my mother? If I cannot send her an interesting bulletin soon, I think she will come here herself.
What notes have you so far?
That you did not curry the last of the duck, as you should have, but fed it to the cat by hand, which was wasteful and indulgent. And also that when you scrubbed the linen press, you did not change the papers that had lain on its shelves, but only put the old ones back after you were done.
That is quite enough for one missive. Do not part with all your best gossip at once. Keep her hungry for the next instalment.
But may I not join you?
No. Suki's face darkens. She is an amenable creature, but since she was so nearly snatched back by her mother, she has displayed a certain nervousness, and is readier to see the necessary compartmenting of their life together as a purposeful exclusion. Next time, Angelica placates her, but she's already flouncing from the room. On the threshold, she turns and draws breath, but her courage confounds her, and she says nothing.
Suki, says Angelica, you are wanted here.
Not by him.
Aye, by Mr. Hancock too.
He has you now.
Angelica feels rather a pang.
He would be very grieved to hear you say that.
She reaches out a hand.
Here, come sit with me. We shall talk on it.
Suki shakes her head and closes the door. As her steps recede up the staircase, Angelica drops her lace into her lap and turns her face to the fire. Trailing her fingers for the cat to butt up against, she feels so tired she can hardly move. She does not know yet that the brief, blunt, but affectionate ministrations of her husband have put her in a particular condition. As yet, its flourishing is of no greater significance than the first shoot of club moss taking root on a stone wall, and although Angelica feels stout and sleepy and tight at the seams, it has not so far occurred to her to wonder why this might be. First, she hears Mrs. Frost, a loud and insistent rapping at the front door, the scamper of Bridget on the stairs. Then she smells her. A great thick floral cloud wafts all the way through to Angelica in the kitchen, as if somebody has dropped a bottle of jasmine, absolute, or dumped all the dead heads of Ranelagh on the hall floor.
Perhaps it is not her. She never wore a scent. She never wore so much.
I am here to see your mistress,
comes Mrs. Frost's clipped little voice.
Here I am,
Angelica calls, stopping to pinch her cheeks in the mirror of the kettle.
Here I am.
But when she comes into the front hall, she sees that the Mrs. Frost, who has arrived, is not the Mrs. Frost of her memory. She is painted and rouged, black and scarlet and white, and her silk skirt crackles lightning bright, and her voluminous fichu quivers and froths, and her puffed-up hair wafts lavender powder every which way. It tumbles and rolls like a snowstorm. Bridget sneezes.
"Eliza," says Angelica, "as narrow a maypole as ever you were."
She tries to stand back. Mrs. Frost's blousy aura makes her large. The hallway is full of her as she cries out,
"Oh, is that little Angelica? Dear, I would not have known you."
"Do not look at me that way," Angelica wants to snap. But she is so surprised by Mrs. Frost's cold, appraising eyes, by her own sudden anger, that she says nothing. Mrs. Frost looks about the hall.
"Why is it so dark in here? Why all this brown paint?"
"It is convenient."
"I know you, Angelica," she speaks playfully. "You love bright colours. You cannot be happy without a papered wall."
"What? And then to scrub the place every day? No, thank you, kindly."
Mrs. Frost stares at her as if appalled, as if she has said something indecent, which surprises Angelica, for she had meant to flaunt her domestic good sense to her old friend's wonder and approval. She lifts up her chin, feeling insolent as a schoolgirl.
"So I sweep my own house."
"Bridget," she says, "we are going to my parlour. Boil some water for our tea. Come this way, Mrs. Frost."
At the foot of the stairs, they pass the closed door of Mr. Hancock's office. Angelica no longer has any inclination to show it off to her friend, for what is there to show off? A comical old strongbox with black rivets, a jumble of papers and ribbons and broken sealing wax, the unsavoury possibility of abandoned beer bottles, reeking pipe dottle. Going up the stairs, she clutches a hank of her skirt tight in each hand that she might climb faster. The wool is wadding in her damp palms. It will crease most certainly. But the fog of Mrs. Frost chases behind her. On the landing, they meet Suki, taking her book upstairs.
"And who is this?" asks Mrs. Frost.
"You did not tell me there was a Miss Hancock, Angelica dear?"
Suki wrinkles her nose.
"My husband has no children. This is his niece, Miss Lippard."
"Oh, but I see the resemblance."
Mrs. Frost seizes Suki's hand.
"Enchanted.
And you are how old, my dear?"
14.
14. Mrs. Frost repeats rapturously. "What an age to be!"
Angelica has never seen her so fawning, and yet that false ebullience is nevertheless familiar.
"'Tis tolerable," says Suki suspiciously.
Angelica tries to convey with her eyes the message, "She is not at all how I remembered her," but it is lost in the awkward air between them. Instead, she tries speech.
"We are going to take tea," she says to Suki. "Will you join us?"
"Oh," says Mrs. Frost, "that would be delightful. I wish to discover everything about you."
Suki regards Mrs. Frost as if she were a mad dog.
"Thank you, no," she says. "I am not at leisure to do any such thing."
"Of course you have a little time," pleads Angelica. "And as a lady of this house, it's only right you take your place at its tea-table."
"You'll forgive me if I do not," says Suki,
and whisks up the stairs. From a safe perch on the next landing, she stares at Mrs. Frost, and mouths consternation at Angelica, who throws her a scowl in exchange and ushers their visitor into the parlour. This room, at least, is nothing at all to be ashamed of, for she oversaw its decoration herself in elegant colours she knows to be fashionable, with a painted floor-cloth, certainly a notch or two finer than those in certain of their old lodgings. There is nothing offensive about the place. Perhaps this is why Mrs. Frost is so offended. She makes a great show of balancing herself on her chair, tussling layers of skirt and petticoat first this way and then that way. "'Tis all right for you,' she says, "'in just a plain little dress. "'These chairs are not designed for great gowns.'
"'No,' says Angelica pleasantly. "'They are not. "'You are very grand, Eliza. "'I think the world is treating you well.'
"'She is studying her friend's face. "'It is formidably painted, eyebrows, cheeks, lips.' So there is not one vulnerable spot, not one inch of her skin left bare.
I used to share a bed with this woman, Angelica thinks.
She remembers the soft, pale skin at the tops of her arms, just losing its firmness, the little creases at the corners of her mouth, the one whisker that grows from under her chin and which Angelica had to pluck for her.
London has been kind to me, says Mrs. Frost. I have brought you something to remember it by.
The parcel she hands over is tied up with red string and smells of orange blossom. Angelica presses her nose against it. Her eyes close, the corners of her lips twitch.
Mille fruits,
she whispers. She tugs the knots loose and the strings slither to the floor. Gold tissue paper crackles as it falls open, the sweetmeats inside are crisp and pale, emanating perfume and toasted sugar.
"'And pain bread here, too!'
she squeaks, fossicking out a little golden sliver baked so hard as to almost be fired. She presses it to her lips for a second before slipping it between her strong back teeth. It cracks, sharp and clean, and she lets it soften a moment on her tongue. Crumbs of cinnamon and nutmeg melt away from shards of almond.
I used to eat these in bed.
She is blushing with pleasure, bringing up her shoulders and wrinkling her still pretty nose as if a lover is kissing her neck.
When did you last taste these things?
She wants me to say, not since my marriage. She wants me to tell her that I am sadder for it. You forget how carefully Mr. Hancock learned my tastes.
She tries to recall her old, heavy-lidded smile and fit it to her face.
You forget I know how to ask for things.
You married him. He's no longer under any imperative to give you them.
He gives because it pleases him.
She nibbles again at her biscuit, cinnamon and almonds between her teeth, the gust of rose water and starch from Mrs. Frost's person. The ghost Angelica, the Angelica she used to be, is standing right at her side. If she were to shuffle just a little this way, she would be back in her body again, looking out through her eyes. Bridget comes with the hot water.
Have you no sweet wine?
Mrs. Frost holds her biscuit, but does not bite into it.
My teeth cost too much to risk in such a way.
Angelica no longer wants to sip Madeira with her friend.
There is only beer in the house, she says.
No.
We find tea strong enough.
She waits for Bridget to leave before she takes out her bunch of keys. One key unlocks the cabinet, where there are kept the tea bowls and the tea caddy. Another unlocks the caddy itself. Mrs. Frost watches in amusement.
What a housewife you are!
That is what I chose.
She knows that the tea bowls, eggshell porcelain with pink roses and the mysterious glyphs of their Chinese artists are a match for anything in the grandest houses. They ought to be, since Mr. Hancock supplies them all. She need not be ashamed of the tea, either.
This we received direct from the quayside. Mr. Hancock is intimate friends with a gentleman from the company. What do you think of it?
They sip in silence. A brooch sparkles at Mrs. Frost's throat when she swallows, almost hidden by her necktie. The stones in it are good, not paste.
"And how has it come to be," says Angelica, "that you are in St. James's?"
Mrs. Frost brightens.
"I have a house there," she says.
"A house? You mean you have a position in a house?"
"I have a house. 'Tis mine. I rent it."
"An entire house?"
Angelica says. Mrs. Frost inclines her head just fractionally, and the light catches her brooch again. At such an angle, there is no mistaking its design. It is a perfect Cupid's arrow.
"Is this a trick? A joke?"
Angelica cannot ask. She has too anxious a sense that this is what Mrs. Frost wants. Instead, she pursues her own questions.
"But what do you want with the whole house?"
"To keep my girls in."
Mrs. Frost lets the silence spin out for a second or two.
"In fact," she continues, "I met one off the stagecoach this very morning."
"A girl?"
15 years of age. A beautiful complexion. 'Tis a shame she cannot read a word, and she carries herself very poorly, but she has a fine voice and a very delicate manner, a rare quality. She will respond to training very well once she leaves off crying."
"Eliza, I did not expect you to resort to this."
"I'm surprised you've heard nothing of it. 'Tis a very new venture, to be sure, but it has attracted a good deal of notice."
"I do not read those scurrilous magazines. Why would I?"
"So you will not know that my Lolly is so sought after I sold her first time for 50 guineas. 50 guineas, Mrs. Hancock!"
"You have risen so quickly."
"I had experience enough."
This, of course, is so. Was she not at Angelica's elbow for every moment of her life? Had it not been her business to know everything of the world and everybody in it? Angelica shakes her head.
"But this house, this fine house you say you have, after we were quite penniless, we had nothing. How did you come by the money?"
Mrs. Frost does not look the slightest bit uncomfortable.
"I had a little capital."
"I had no capital," Angelica thinks. "I had nothing at all."
But she cannot say it. Her tongue feels thick in her mouth as she tries instead.
"You were always clever with money. Cleverer than I."
"You had your own talents."
"You kept my books so well."
She spits her words out, eyes narrowing. But Mrs. Frost just smiles and sips her tea. She will not own it. It is as if it has not happened. It is as if she has not come here wearing Angelica's own jewellery. They sit.
"I believe," says Angelica, "that you came here with the intention of communicating certain things to me. Is there anything else you desire me to know?"
"Did you scheme this all along?" she wants to demand. "Or did the opportunity merely present itself?" "No," says Mrs. Frost. "I believe you perceive things just as they are. Oh, and I suppose you've not heard. Our old friend, Mrs. Chapel."
"What of her?"
Angelica feels a sudden chill.
"Is she well?"
"Well enough. She has been in trouble, though. The law."
She delivers her news with relish, but Angelica wafts it away.
"The usual charges. Bless you, Frost, you have so very much to learn about this game. She'll pay the fine, and that will be the end of it."
Mrs. Frost cuts her eyes nastily.
"I cannot share your confidence. She is not so much in favour as she once was."
Nonsense.
Angelica looks at her askance. Mrs. Chapel will always have her protectors. Her influence is unrivaled. Downstairs, the clock is striking 6. The front door goes, and Mr. Hancock is stamping and hallooing in the hall.
Your husband is home.
He is coming up the stairs, calling, Angelica! Angelica!
Mrs. Hancock, where be you?
In here,
she tries to say, but her voice falters. She feels quite overcome. He throws open the door, and he is all a fluster, his excitement hanging around him in a horsey-smelling halo of sweat. One of the knees of his breeches is torn wide open, and black blood is caked on his porky knee. He claps her on the shoulder and kisses the frill of her cap. There is a long smear of what might be soot on his cheek.
Good news, he cries. Good news, my little pigeon.
Mrs. Frost is here, says Angelica.
Oh, good evening, Mrs. Frost, good evening.
He's been drinking, smirks Mrs. Frost. But Angelica does not care. She cannot get close enough to her husband, her foolish, honest husband. She is scooting around him, dusting him down, taking his coat from his shoulders and shaking it out.
What have you been at? What have you done to yourself?
Wished, it doesn't signify. I lost my footing.
And your knuckles?
She drops her voice to an uxorial whisper.
Have you been brawling?
Nothing of the sort.
I must go,
says Mrs. Frost. She looks delighted. Mr. Hancock remembers himself.
I have been most improper,
he says, crestfallen.
I have burst in on you ladies when I ought to have kept to myself.
Not at all, says Mrs. Frost, rising. It is time I left.
Will you stay to dine?
Says Mr. Hancock.
I have an engagement. I came only to look in on your wife. I shall see you out.
Yes, Mr. Hancock. Please see her out, says Angelica. Goodbye, Eliza.
Mr. Hancock clatters down the stairs, taking with him the great waft of Mrs. Frost. Angelica waits on the threshold of the parlour, dithering, her hand raised to her breastbone. She hears the front door close, then her husband calling.
Angelica! My little wife! Come to me. Let me tell you about your new home.
What are you about, Mr. Hancock?
She trots down the dark stairs.
Some candles want lighting down here.
I have bought you that house, my angel. I inspected it most carefully, and it is just so. Very grand. I wish you would excuse my bursting in. I felt my news could not wait, but I do see that it was not a gentlemanly action. It's in the countryside, above Greenwich, Mrs. Hancock, exactly to your tastes. A la mode, my dear. A la mode.
You have truly bought a house.
He smells of the alehouse, and there is sawdust stuck to his boots.
Truly,
he says.
Well, why did you not announce it while that horrid woman was here? I should have liked to see her face.
Ha! That would have given her something to chew over.
You're certain it's all ours? You're certain it is so grand?
Of course, of course. You will be astounded.
He takes off his hat and his wig and scrubs his palms over his bristly scalp.
Oh, better,
he says, sliding his thumbs under the straining waistband of his breeches.
And better yet, if I had something to drink.
Rapping his stick against the floor so it might be heard all over the house.
Bridget! Where is Bridget?
Stop your banging. Come and sit by the fire. I shall fetch us something.
And so the erstwhile Angelica Neal, in her caraco and her cap, trots willingly into the pantry to bring her husband small beer and cold boiled beef. She bolts the shutters and lights the candles and comes to the dark wood table in the dining room with two pewter plates and a loaf of bread. Mr. Hancock stokes up the fire and unrolls the plan of the house on the table, weighing down one corner with a candlestick and another with the mustard pot. He and his wife sit elbow to elbow, eating their beef and supping their beer.
"Here is the dining room,"
says Mr. Hancock, tracing a greasy paw over it.
"And here the music room and the staircase. I'd thought these rooms here for your own personal use, but you might choose different when you see them for yourself. They are very proper, my dear, not showy at all. You need not worry." "I do not mind a little show, where it is tasteful."
The candlelight and the patter of rain on the flagged yard outside are soporific. Angelica leans against her husband's shoulder, with his stout arm around her and his fingers palping at her waist. She is more certain of her feelings now. And since there is nobody else to tell, she turns to her husband and murmurs,
"I do not want to see that woman again."
"Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Frost, I do not think she's a good person."
"She was your dear friend."
He blinks his blonde eyelashes, but he's not arguing with her. He wants to hear what she has to say. She flops her head back against him.
"She spent 10 years reminding me I ought to be other than I am. She disdained me when I was not respectable, and now that I am, she sneers at me."
"She sneered at you? In this house? In the house you are mistress of?"
"She wishes to see me as a failure. She wishes to make me ashamed. And shall I tell you one other thing?"
"Go on."
He slips his fingers under her cap and strokes the hair over her ear.
"When I was ruined, when I married you, I do now believe that I was not quite ruined."
"What do you mean?"
"Did you not see the change in her? She is rich."
"So she has had help from somewhere?"
"Yes, from my own purse. She kept all my accounts. She ran my house. She had not a penny of her own. She would have been on the street if I had not helped her. So how is it that when I became destitute, she had a nest egg?"
"It don't mean she took it from you."
"She was wearing my pin today. My diamond pin. Cool as cream cheese, she was, coming into my house wearing my old jewels. She never cared for me, and she cares for me now even less."
"Now, my girl,
she is a hypocrite,"
says Angelica with finality.
"I will not speak of her again."
She folds her arms on the table and rests her chin on them.
"Tell me more about our house."
"It has a folly," he says, "a summer house."
"Oh, I shall enjoy that. I can eat ices in it."
"And underneath the summer house, the most curious thing."
"What is it?"
"A shell grotto."
She clasps her hands and opens her eyes wide.
"Grand indeed."
"I knew you would be pleased. It even has a little pool in it, which must be fed by the spring. The agent said that the place had no function, but I know better. It is for our mermaid."
"Our mermaid that has not yet been vouchsafed to us. Our little fakement."
"This is a sign."
"I am content with only a grotto. I shall be its nymph. If only Mrs. Frost knew, she has no grotto. What else does this house have?"
"There is a fruit orchard. You will eat plums all summer. And there are stables with a phaeton for me to drive you in. There are many bedrooms."
"But I want no visitors," she says. No visitors at all. I want only us.
Nobody else?
No.
Her heart is agitated. Who would come? Mrs. Chapel? Belle Fortescue? To sneer?
No children?
He says it just too sharply. He does not mean to fix his eyes so firmly upon her, but he cannot help it. She does not know what to do with her expression. She has never been in such a position. She does not know how to have any feelings about it at all.
Perhaps,
she says, and knows she has said something near enough to the right thing, for he clasps her hand tightly. Inside Angelica, something is multiplying.
What of the expense?
She demands. She likes it when he talks and she listens. She sprawls further over the table, sinking her cheek into the cradle of her own arms. His gruff voice is not musical, but his words are beyond soothing to her.
All settled, he is saying. All taken care of. Paid in full. Nothing else to trouble ourselves with. All straightforward now, I should venture.
While he talks, she reaches up to rub her knuckles fondly and firmly over his bristly jowls, and yawns, and smiles, and thinks, is it really so unlikely that she might find herself in love with him? Chapter 5. He takes Angelica up to the heath. High up in the sky, a kite is swooping, its beribboned tail flying out behind it, and on the tender grass beneath it, children caper and whoop. The wind catches Angelica's skirts, so she is nearly a kite herself, tottering along the drive as the breeze tries to snatch her up. Her hair flies over her eyes, and she puts up both arms to keep her hat on her head, but standing in front of her new home, she laughs and laughs. He sends an order with the eagle for monogrammed porcelain. He sends an order with the angel for good chintz. He sends Angelica and Suki out to choose new silverware. The spring, which began as one warm, bright day, followed after a week of rain by another, has extended into a whole unbroken string of them, and there are now moments that Mr. Hancock becomes agitated for the fate of Captain Tyso Jones' venture upon the unicorn. Why does it take so long to return? Sometimes he puts his hands on his desk and leans forward out of the open window, scanning the bobbing masts of the ships beyond the Deptford rooftops and praying that all is well. At night he dreams of Javanese mermaids, teeming in the black water of his own grotto as if they spawned there. Or else he dreams of a buxom, fish-tailed beauty, with sticks of coral in her swirling yellow hair, and her bosom languidly rising with the movement of a warm tide. In his dreams she lies in a bathtub of mother-of-pearl, and when he lifts her out she is slippery and heavy, a cold, dead weight slithering through his arms. In his dream, he picks her up and staggers across a shell-shaped room with her in a kind of ungainly caper, she always dragging him to the floor while her dampness seeps through his shirt and the smell of oysters envelops them both. When she turns her cool, wet face to his, it is always Angelica's that he sees. Chapter 6. A week before their removal to the new house, Angelica and the girls Suki and Bridget climb up to the lumber room under the eaves at Union Street to sort through the Hancock family effects.
There is nothing here worth keeping, says Angelica. Nothing of taste or value.
She nudges a dusty wooden cradle with the toe of her slipper and sets it rocking.
We must throw it all out. My mother will not like to hear of that, says Suki. Your mother may deal with her own lumber room. This one is mine now, and I say it all must go.
Some good woman will make use of these things, says Bridget thoughtfully.
Do you think so? 'Tis all quite ugly.
But sturdy, says Bridget, and nobody would disdain a good wool blanket like this one, or bed linen, when their own is worn through.
Worn through? What? Right through?
So you can see daylight through the middle, in just the shape of the bodies that lay in them. In my mother's house, we cut them down the worn part and stitch them back together along the opposite sides. Get twice the wear that way. But these sheets are good, madam. These'll do somebody for many years yet.
Well, I never was so destitute as to cut my bed sheets in half. I never was.
Angelica is impressed.
I kept body and soul together very adequate, all told.
Aye, and how was that?
Asks Suki. She and Bridget are both fearsomely interested in Mrs. Hancock's previous occupation.
That don't signify, she sniffs. I did what I must.
Until Uncle rescued you.
Rescued me?
Angelica laughs.
Is that what you believe?
I, says Suki. I rescued you, and now you may reform and be good.
Angelica feels not entirely easy. Certainly she was desperate. Certainly she was glad to have him perceive himself as her rescuer. But never in her darkest hour did she imagine that she might not make her own way through tribulation.
A dubious hero he is, she says lightly.
Which is better, ma'am?
Bridget interrupts.
Living here with us, or back in London with all the sweetmeats and the beaux?
Each has their privations, I dare say. It's best wherever the living is easiest. Say, Bridget, these poor people who have no bedsheets, what have they done to find themselves in such a position of want?
Why, nothing.
Quite blameless?
As blameless as anybody can be, the world being what it is.
Ah, that was their mistake. Do you know where they might be found?
I do.
Very near to here?
Not 10 minutes' walk away.
Well, Bridget, I trust you to identify some individuals of great want and take these things to them immediately. Suki, you had better help her.
Angelica is loading bales of linen and wool into her step-niece's arms.
And when you're there, find a wagon and have it called by here, and we shall put everything else on it.
Bridget staggers from the room, with her chin ratcheted as high as it will go above the pile of cloth in her arms. And Suki follows her down.
Be careful on the stairs, girls!
Alone in the attic, Angelica smooths down her skirts. She feels pleased with herself, warmed by her own surprising beneficence. She's never given to the poor before. It is her first truly grand act. But when I'm in the big house, she thinks, this will be usual for me. She imagines standing kindly on her doorstep, pressing shiny coins into the hands of a beggar boy and his blind mother. At Christmas, she will send a ham to the almshouse. When she dies, they will distribute mourning rings, and the orphan children will weep. Downstairs, there is a knock on the door. Perhaps it is not the first knock, for it has a frustrated, impatient sound to it.
Confound them, she mutters. I will not answer it.
But it may be the woman who sells the buns she likes. She thinks for a moment. Then she takes off down the stairs, tucking her hair into her cap as best she can. For a minute, the knocking leaves off, but when she is on the final turn of the stairs, it goes again.
Patience!
She shouts, and throws the door open. Mrs. Frost is there, all in lilac, with the tassels of a vast parasol quivering around her head like a carousel.
Good day,
she says, smiling. She has had a gold tooth put in.
"'Tis you."
"'So it is. I was passing, and I thought how nice it would be. My old friend."
"'You were passing? What were you passing to? The victualling yard? The tannery? Did you think to buy yourself